is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Don Showalter from USA Basketball, and you are listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today. When you were in Indiana, did you ever get a chance to have any interaction with Larry Bird?
Larry would come out to practice. You'd always watch practice, and he'd always talk trash. He was a big trash talker at practices, telling people he could outshoot you and all that kind of stuff. Very nervous when he was watching practices.
Former NBA player C.J. Watson played for 5 different teams during his career, including the Warriors, Bulls, Nets, Pacers, and Magic. Watson has also played overseas in Greece, Italy, and Turkey during his career. CJ was originally signed to a 10-day contract by the Warriors, where he impressed Coach Don Nelson as a backup to Baron Davis. Watson also played with Derrick Rose during his 2011-2012 MVP season, battling Rose every day in practice while averaging just under 10 points per game that year with the Bulls. Watson played his college basketball for the Tennessee Volunteers for 4 seasons. He finished his collegiate career as Tennessee's 2nd all-time leader in assists and steals while scoring 1,424 points. While his basketball experience is impressive, his skills go far beyond the basketball court. Philanthropy has been at the center of Watson's career since he developed a scholarship fund that honors his late grandmother and helps to support students studying education. Watson also started the Quiet Storm Foundation in his hometown of Las Vegas. The foundation was established in order to foster learning opportunities to help young kids grow and achieve their goals in his community. In addition to his nonprofits, Watson has developed a children's book series titled CJ's Big Dream. With this series, he hopes to inspire young kids to chase their dreams and work hard for what they want. We just launched our Hoop Heads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. This week, we dropped episode 1 of Thrive with Trevor Huffman, the first show from our newly created Hoop Heads Podcast Network. Thrive with Trevor Huffman will take you into the lives, minds, habits, and routines of the world's best and brightest to help you improve your performance. Make sure you check it out. 2 more shows are coming soon. Please rate and review both Thrive and the Hoop Heads Pod on your favorite podcast app. Get ready to learn from the basketball experiences of former NBA player turned author, CJ Watson. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to welcome former NBA player CJ Watson. CJ, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm great. Doing very well. Excited to have you on. Talk a little bit of basketball, learn more about your professional career, talk a little bit about your college career, and get into some of the interesting things that you've been doing since you've been retired. So let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Just talk to us a little bit about how you got in the game of basketball when you were younger.
I just got in the game of basketball just by playing with my dad and my little brother. My dad and my mom played basketball, so they were both into sports, and they wanted us to be in sports, and just naturally we just had a love for the game, playing in the front yard, in the street, on the basketball goal, and just being very competitive with my younger brother, having those sibling fights all the time, sometimes leading into fights and getting in trouble, but it was all in love and fun.
Did you play anything else besides basketball, or was basketball your main thing?
I played everything. Actually, football is my favorite sport. That's something that I wanted to play, but I just never did. And because it was too hot here in Vegas, so I just didn't want to play with pads on. So I just stayed in the air condition where it was a little bit cooler. But I played everything: baseball, football, ran track, did pretty much everything.
Do you think that
multi-sport athlete background benefited you as you got up and started to focus on basketball as you got older?
I think so. Yeah, maybe definitely focus on one sport because I knew I couldn't play a whole bunch of sports like I really wanted to. So I know how to pick on one and pick one that I was probably best at and can see myself having a future in. And basketball was that sport. And my whole thing with basketball was just for me going to college. I knew my parents couldn't pay for college, so I know I had to get to college some way. And I wanted to really go to college. I know the only way I can get there was through a basketball scholarship and keep my grades good enough to get into college. And that was really my whole focus from playing basketball.
When did that start? Like, when did you start to look around at the landscape and say to yourself, I'd really love the opportunity to go and play college basketball and earn a scholarship so I can go to school? When did that start to enter your mind?
Probably not to maybe freshman year or sophomore year. Freshman year, I played on JV, but I got hurt. I tore my hamstring, so I didn't play the whole year. So I got to really just sit back and look and really kind of find myself as a young kid and then find the game of basketball, see the ins and outs and see it from a different perspective instead of always just playing it. And just from then on, I just wanted to really, really rebound from my freshman year and prove to people that I was good enough to play varsity. And then from there on, I just went soaring, really.
What was your process for improving and getting better when you were in high school? What did you do to get yourself prepared to be at your best?
Just outworking the competition, outworking my opponents, outworking teammates also, and just really just staying in the gym. I was a skinny young kid, so I had to kind of beef up. So I did a lot of push-ups and calf raises. I don't know if people remember like those jumping shoes, the jump soles.
Oh, yeah. I had a pair of those.
Right, yeah, everyone did. I used to put the whole workout on my wall and do like the little – every day you do 10 calf raises and the next day you do 20. I did all that kind of stuff. And I just try to just be better. I mean, I wasn't the greatest athlete, but I just feel like I worked harder than other people because there's definitely people that in my city that were, I feel like, better than me, but kind of just didn't put the work in, but definitely had more talent than I did.
Was it work mostly individual, you getting in the gym and just working on your game? Was it pickup games? Was it your AAU experience? What was it like for you in terms of maybe what your summer looked like, what your routine was like?
It was a little bit of both. A lot of it was individual with my mom, with my dad, my brother running in early in the mornings. Then after like maybe that first month after school ended, it was more team, going with teammates, getting my teammates to run with me or going to the gym, getting shots up. And then really AAU is when I really kind of took off and get my first letter. And that's when I really realized that this college thing could be real and people had attention in my game and in me and wanted me to see me play in college.
Who was the first letter from?
It was crazy because it was from University of Indiana after my sophomore year after we won state. And I never would have thought Bobby Knight would have sent me a letter of all the people, all the coaches.
You still have it?
No, I don't still have it. I don't know where that letter is.
That's exciting though, man. It's always cool to get that first one. And because I think up until that point, you never know. You think that it's out there and you think that you're going to get an opportunity. And then all of a sudden that thing shows up and you're carrying around and going, hey, this is a little bit of proof that maybe I can do something with my basketball career. What was your best memory from your time in high school? What do you remember most? Maybe one or two things that stick out about your high school career?
I think just the time that we put in to prep for the season, the behind the scenes people that people don't see, those early mornings running late hours in the gym, late hours in the weight room, and then having that preparation and having that lead into a state championship 2 out of 3 years is pretty cool and definitely one of the fondest memories.
Are you still in touch with any of your guys from high school, your teammates?
Yeah, actually, we were supposed to get together for like a 20-year reunion because our first championship was 20 years this year. And the corona virus stuff happened and just kind of put a hold on everything. But we all on our group text and definitely I was excited to see everyone and hopefully we can still do it in the future.
Yeah, that's very cool. I think when you get a chance, you think about the time that you spend, whether it's with the high school teammates, college teammates, and it's probably a little bit different in the pro level where guys are switching teams and moving around a little bit more. But just the bond that you have with your high school guys, I'm sure your college teammates, is just something that people who haven't experienced it at those levels, I don't think ever really understand what that bond is like for players at both the high school and the college level. So when did you start to really think that the opportunity to go and play college basketball is going to become a reality? And then just talk a little bit about your recruitment, how you ended up going from Vegas to Tennessee.
My first letter was from Indiana. And after that, I knew that I mean, we just won state, and I knew that a lot of our seniors were leaving. It was time for me to step into hopefully a starting role and maybe a bigger role. And I just wanted to kind of build on that and keep building on that and get more letters and more letters. And my dream school was to go to UCLA. And the coach at the time, Steve Lavin, he just got fired right before I was going to commit to them. And then Tennessee, I had one big tournament in Tennessee, came knocking at the door and just really offered me everything, really, from starting the first day I got there to having the reins of the ship and trying to build something at Tennessee and get to the NCAA tournament, all that kind of stuff. And I just didn't want to turn that down. And my family was from there also, so it made a big adjustment on my college decision also.
Was the opportunity to play right away a big factor?
Yeah, that was definitely one of the biggest factors. I could have stayed maybe at UNLV or something like that and stayed home, but I didn't want to sit and wait. I wanted to really be thrown into the fire, see how good it was, see if I can really compete with the best of the best, even as a freshman, and then just build from there.
The facilities at Tennessee are second to none.
Yeah, it's crazy. I wouldn't choose any other school because they definitely do it right. They put a lot of effort into building their players, building their programs, and getting the best out of each player.
How engaged are you with Tennessee's program now? Do you still get back and maybe catch a game once in a while? Are you still in contact with the current staff?
Yeah, definitely. The current staff wasn't my coach, but I still go back and talk with him. Coach Barnes, he's a great guy. Met him a couple times. Went to a couple games, and definitely try to catch maybe one or two games a year if it's not close to Vegas, or go back to the Tennessee or Nashville or something like that. So they're definitely doing a great job, and I think they'll be back in the top 20 and back in the thick of things next year.
So your college career, I'm just looking at your college stats here in front of me. So you missed having a perfect record of starting every game by one game, it looks like. So do you remember the game you didn't start?
Yeah. It was a game out of respect for our senior, because our senior, it was his last game, and he never started. So coach came to me and asked me if I wanted to start or not, because I think it was still a big game for us that we still needed to win or whatnot. And I definitely wanted to pay respect to him. It's just, he was a walk-on. He never really got to play or anything like that. So it was definitely a ode to him. And I definitely would still do it anytime, even if it messed up my perfect record.
Well, let's put it this way. There's not many guys who either have a perfect record or only miss out on starting one game for as noble of a reason as what you just shared, especially over the course of, you think about guys doing that for a four-year career. That's a pretty good achievement.
Yeah, it was definitely fun, and I learned a lot that first year.
What was your biggest adjustment going from high school basketball to college basketball? Do you remember?
Because I played mostly point guard in college. In high school, I played mostly two guard, a little bit of both, but I was mainly a scorer in high school. And then when I went to college, I was a little bit of both, kind of a scorer, but I had a lot of seniors on my team who could score the ball, so I had to learn how to get other guys the ball who are bigger than me, who could probably score at a more better dynamic rate than I could. And they were seniors also, so they weren't letting me take all the shots anyway.
If you had your choice, all things being equal, which position did you like better? Did you have a preference as you look back over the course of your time?
Just as I was growing into a point guard and getting more in tune with the role, I think a point guard is more dynamic. Scoring is cool, but being a point guard, you're a leader on the court. You can also score. You're a passer. You gotta know plays. You gotta know where everyone is supposed to be. So I think it's a bigger role, and I liked it.
So when you think back to your time at Tennessee, just like I asked you with high school, what are one or two things that stand out the most about your college career?
I would say just meeting different people and getting able to travel to different cities, see different campuses. A lot of those schools in the SEC are big, big-time programs in football and basketball. And some of those schools, if I didn't go to Tennessee, I probably would have wished I went to maybe Kentucky or Florida or something like that. And just to see those different places and cities and get to visit those cities is probably nothing you can exchange for that, and it was doing it for free, so it was no cost.
That's a good way to travel.
Yeah,
that is a good way to travel. What was your favorite arena that you guys played in? It could be one maybe in the SEC that you played in regularly, or maybe you went somewhere and just played a one-off game somewhere. What was your favorite place you ever played?
I think Kentucky is probably up there. It's always loud. It's always noisy. The fans are great there. I would say there or Florida. Florida has a great atmosphere. It's small. The fans are kind of right on top of you, and they're loud, and they're doing the little alligator chomp sign. So it's pretty cool, especially to win there on the road. It's a big victory.
Yeah, there's nothing better than winning in front of a big crowd and getting them quiet. I always said that I think I enjoyed the opportunity to play in front of a big crowd and win on the road as much as fun as it is to win at home and have the crowd going crazy and on your side. It's also fun to make a big shot or win a big game and just hear silence from a crowd that 5 minutes earlier had been going nuts.
Yeah, it's nothing like that. It's the best.
All right. So at what point, obviously, I'm sure in the back of your head as you're making your college decision back in high school, you're thinking in the back of your head, as every kid does growing up, playing with your family on the driveway, that, hey, someday I'd like to play in the league. And at what point do you start to think that, hey, I'm going to have at least an opportunity to be able to go and maybe make a living in the NBA?
I honestly never thought about it until maybe I got to college. After my first or second year playing with I played for the USA team after my freshman year, and a lot of guys on that team were probably one or two and done, like Darren Williams, D. Brown, J.J. Redick, Mo Egger, and a lot of those guys were talking about it just in friendly, you know, teammate conversation, locker room conversation, and I never honestly really thought about it until after that, and after that I really started taking heed and trying to work on things that I might need to add to my game to make it to the next level. But if you ask my dad's friends growing up when I was younger, I always used to say, I'm going to play in the NBA one day. But I can't remember back that far. So I don't remember those conversations and those talks.
Understood. It wasn't necessarily a real conversation. It was just you talking and doing the things you did out on the driveway. Totally understand, like every kid did.
Yeah.
So when you talked about things that you needed to add to your game, when you're obviously having a lot of success as a college player and you start thinking about projecting yourself to the next level, what were some things that, let's say, as you were heading into your senior year that you started thinking about, hey, if I want to get to the NBA, I got to really start working to develop this. Do you remember what some of those specific things might have been?
Definitely working on my three-point shooting, being a more dynamic scorer from the point guard position, and being more efficient. And then also just being a better leader, being more vocal, because that was a big thing with me, because I'm really shy and quiet. So just being more vocal and demanding things from myself and from my teammates, but just being more vocal about it.
How'd you force yourself to do that? I'm just curious, because I know a lot of players sometimes are hesitant, if that's not your personality, to kind of get out and be that type of leader. So what did you do, or how did you go about improving that? Because that thing seems like something that when it's not your personality, sometimes that's difficult to get to.
Definitely was, because I definitely wasn't the one to scream and yell, but in certain times, in certain situations, I would. But I just think it comes with time. It comes with maturity. It comes with knowing your teammates, knowing your coaches, knowing those around you. It's a crazy story, because after my freshman year, my coach, Buzz Peterson, he sent me to a leadership conference in Florida, Orlando, Florida, Disney World, that they have every year for college athletes and people who go to college. And I went to this leadership conference, and he wanted me to be more vocal, be more louder, be more demanding. And I still came back the same way. And he thought it would really change me. I mean, I learned a lot from the conference. I learned different things, but I was still the same person. But as I got older, I started to, you know, be more vocal, more loud, more talking, but all that kind of stuff. But it was just a funny story that he really made me go to a leadership conference.
Thought it was going to be a miraculous transformation.
Yeah, at least he wanted the best for me, so I can't blame him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's funny. And I think that's totally true, that you have to, I think, as a leader, you have to come to that realization, and you have to kind of get there on your own terms, on your own pace, especially when it's something that you're not naturally inclined to do. I've seen that with players that I played with. I've seen it with players that I've coached, where there's just some players that naturally have that outgoing spirit, that ability to get on a teammate in a positive way and demand more from them. And then there are other guys who just are those quiet leaders who just kind of go about and say, I'm going to do it by leading by example. And I think right. that it's, I think it's difficult for those lead by example guys to really become the opposite type of leader. I think you can do it, but yeah. I think it definitely is a challenge to go against what your natural personality is.
Yeah, definitely for sure. Yeah.
All right. So talk about the transition from Tennessee to the NBA. Just talk a little bit about your pre-draft process and then just kind of going into the beginning of your professional career.
The pre-draft process was fun. I know I worked hard day and night after the season ended my senior year, and went on some a lot of personal workouts with different teams and thought I was going to get drafted, but it didn't happen. And then I went overseas. The decision to go overseas was I just needed some money, really. I was a broke college student. Never grew up with money or anything like that. So I wanted to go and make some money for myself and for my family, and then just basically see the world, because I didn't want to stay in America, or I think it was called the D League at the time, and play there. So I thought my best chances were to play overseas and make some money, go to a different country and see the world, and then come back and maybe hopefully play summer league and try to get on a team from there. But I definitely enjoyed my first year. It was definitely an up and down year. I don't know if this has happened to anyone you've talked to, but my whole career overseas, my first year, I had a different coach every month. So every month someone got fired. So it was definitely different trying to adjust and being a quiet guy like I am, trying to adjust to a new coach and a new offense and a new situation every month. So it was definitely hard on that part. But the other part, I definitely enjoyed it.
All right. So I don't know if that qualifies for my question that I asked to everybody who's played overseas. But my question is, what's the craziest overseas basketball story? So having a new coach every month, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But I bet you have another one, that something that happened while you were over there that's even wackier.
I don't know if it's crazy, but I mean, I guess if you play overseas, you're not used to it, but it happens. Fans were fighting, fans were throwing. It was in a game. We were winning on a road trip, and the fans were throwing pennies and lighters at us, and it was just something that is very dangerous, and that's not normal in America by our standards, I guess. But they had police at the game policing us. They had little fire sticks in the crowd, so it was definitely crazy just to be in that kind of atmosphere.
All right, so beyond the basketball piece of it, what did it do for you as a human being in terms of being in a different culture? What did you take away from it as a person, not necessarily as a basketball player?
I just had to grow up fast. I was overseas by myself for the majority of the time. Being 21, I had to learn how to cook for myself. I had to learn how to do a whole bunch of other things. I mean, and I just really kind of just found myself, read a lot of books, went on walking trips daily just to kind of kill time, because I was pretty bored just there being by myself, because a lot of my teammates, my American teammates, were older than me, and they had like their wives or girlfriends there and kids. So it was like I was just really kind of just by myself besides being on the road with my teammates.
What country were you in?
Italy.
Italy. Okay. So how does the opportunity to come back and get an opportunity with the NBA, how does that take place?
I came back over from overseas and played with the Spurs for two summers in a row, and didn't make the team. I was close to signing a contract, but it didn't happen. And then I decided to stay in the D League this year, because I said my overseas experience wasn't the greatest, so I didn't want to go back over there. So I just said I'm just try the D League out and try to work on things that they said I couldn't do, which is be a scorer, be a better leader, all that kind of stuff. And then eventually had a great month in the D League and got the call up to go to the Golden State Warriors.
What was that like when that call came in?
It was fun, because my agent was telling me I was playing good the first couple weeks, and you're definitely going to get a call up. You're definitely going to do this. And I just told him, I don't want to hear all that. I don't want to hear you keep telling me this and it's not happening. So just don't call me until you know for sure I'm getting a call up. And he didn't. I hadn't talked to him really for like 2.5 weeks. And the next time I talked to him, he was like, you're going to get a call up. And it was crazy, because it was between two different teams, the Charlotte Bobcats at the time and the Golden State Warriors. So who knows how it would have turned up if I went to the Bobcats. I don't know if my career would have been as long as it is, or as long as it was.
It's interesting. I think that you think about guys who have made it to the league and then they stick. And so much of it is, I think, And it's what you're describing right there is situational, whether that's right. the situation of the front office who somebody believes in you, whether it's the coach, somebody who believes in you, whether it's just you're in the right situation with the players that are on your team and you get an opportunity. So what do you think it was for you with the Warriors? Don Nelson, what was it about the Warriors that you think helped you to get your career started and then enabled you to play and, you know, have a 10-year career?
I think, like you said, it's a situation. It's about timing. Coach Nelson's offense was perfect for me. That's the kind of style that I like to play, up and down, kind of run and gun style. And that's what they were doing. They were one of the best teams who actually probably started, if not invented, that style and played small. And that's really how my game kind of grew. He just threw me into the fire. He told me he wanted to see what I had and if I could stick, and just threw me out there, and I played pretty well and kept getting the first 10 days, then the second 10 day, and then the last one for the rest of the season. And he just kept believing in me and pouring confidence into me.
It's amazing. You go from out of the league and playing overseas to a fringe guy signing a 10-day contract and then another 10-day contract. Then you sign out for the rest of the year. And then, like I said, you're able to parlay that into a long 10-year career in the NBA. It's a pretty incredible story.
Yeah, that was my whole goal. Like when I first went to the D-League, I said I wanted to just see if I can make it. And if not, you know, if I don't make it playing basketball, I'll do something else or whatever. But once I got that call up, I said, I'm never going back to the D-League or overseas or whatever. So and my teammates were like, yeah, don't come back. Don't come back. So I was like, I promise I won't come back.
That's funny. Yeah, I could see once you get a taste of the NBA life that you probably going back overseas or going to the D-League probably wouldn't be your first choice if you could avoid it, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely not.
All right, so when you were at Golden State, who was your favorite teammate with the Warriors?
Probably Baron Davis. He was a guy that I obviously looked up to and played with on the video games, all that kind of stuff. And just to be on the same court with him, it was just like kind of like surreal. But all my teammates were great. I learned a lot from all those guys. Steven Jackson, Al Harrington, Matt Barnes, Monte Ellis. And even, like I said, Coach Nelson was a big contributor to that. So they all played a big role in my development.
Have you been on Jackson and Barnes podcast yet?
No, not yet. I don't think they want me on there. I'm not big time enough for their podcast. Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, man, you got to keep working. You can slum
right,
down.
Yeah, I got to make
slum,
it get me.
You can slum down with us first, and then
no,
you can.
No, that's all right. I'll definitely be here anytime.
then you can get down there and get with them. So you leave Golden State, and then you go to Chicago. Talk about your experience with the Bulls.
It was fun. I didn't think I would ever get a chance to play for a franchise like that. And when the call came, I was just like, yeah, just let's do it. And I know the first year when we played there, we weren't even projected to be in the playoffs. And we just kept playing well. And Coach Tibbs had us all dialed in and locked in and provided us with so much information from top to bottom on every player. And he just had us prepared. I think that's why we were so focused, because the practices were definitely harder than the games, I feel like, and that's why we were so successful.
All right, so I got to ask you from a Bulls standpoint, first question about Tibbs. What Tibbs' professional reputation from a public standpoint compared to the guy behind the scenes? How do those two compare?
They're kind of the same, but not the same. I mean, he's not as hard as people I think he is. He's definitely a fun, loose, loving guy. Obviously, he doesn't have like a wife or kids or anything. That's why he's so dedicated to basketball. But all that just comes from, like, you know, wanting to be successful. He took just a longer route to get to being a head coach. Went through every step, being an assistant to whatever, the player development, all that kind of stuff. And to finally get to his head coaching job, that's what he wanted and that's what he lived for. So, I mean, you can't knock a guy who dreamed and worked hard to be where he's at.
Absolutely. All right. So during the years you're with the Bulls there, you're seeing pretty close to peak Derrick Rose.
Yeah.
Describe what that was like going up against him every day in practice.
It was fun because I went up against him a couple times before just playing against him. You know, but practice was like it was tough. It was, that's why I knew I could play against any guard, especially playing against him in practice all the time, because we used to have to go one-on-one against each other, 2-on-2. And those matchups, I think, brought the best out of me and him, because anyone I went up against, I didn't think they were anywhere near Derrick Rose. And I've seen him do some damage to a lot of people and made a lot of people just call for switches and call for like, oh, I don't want to guard him tonight. So he was definitely a sight to see and great to play with.
Yeah, from an athleticism standpoint there at his peak before the injuries.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's been anybody at the point guard position that was as athletically gifted as he was. And then just, you know, you think about winning the MVP at whatever he was, 22, 23 years old. It's just, I mean, it's incredible. And it's such a shame that his career was cut short. Probably one of the bigger what ifs, probably the last 20 years for sure in the league.
Right. Yeah, definitely for sure. I think he's even still then bounced back great. And he's still a productive point guard. I mean, you still can't sleep on him.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. When he was here, we're from Cleveland, and so we had him when he was here and looked like at that point when he was with the Cavs that his career was pretty much over, it looked like. I mean, it didn't look like he had a whole lot left, and now he's really bounced back and had a couple of really good years since he left the Cavs, and it's really great to see because, again, you hate to see a guy that had that much talent, that much athleticism be – shortchanged because of injury. It's just, you know, obviously we can go through the history of the league and see that that's happened to many guys over the course of time. But it's just something that you hate to see a guy who has that much potential and is so good, so young, and the fact that you kind of got robbed of seeing what he could have been like if he would have stayed healthy his entire career.
Right, for sure. Yeah, definitely part of. Hopefully, would have brought a championship to Chicago by now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, talk to us a little bit about just, from a pro basketball standpoint, just when you're changing teams. So for you and your career, you played for five, six different teams?
Five different teams, yep.
What's it like when you go from one locker room to the other? Just talk about the adjustment as you change teams, going from a different system. How similar are the systems? How big of an adjustment is there from place to place? Just talk a little bit about the transition from one team to another.
It's definitely different. You got to adjust because, you know, you have different egos, different personalities in every different locker room. And you don't never know how you can mesh with those personalities. But for me, I think I was fortunate enough to say that I got to kind of pick my teams. Being a free agent, I played for every team probably 2 years. I get to pick where I wanted to go, where I wanted to play. And when I was choosing those teams, I wanted to see what players were on those teams, what kind of system they ran, and see if I would fit in those systems. So, like I said, I got fortunate enough to be able to choose those teams where I thought I would fit pretty good in every situation, regardless who was on the team or who wasn't, and just really kind of just went from there.
All right. So, you obviously, in the course of that time, not only did you play for five different teams, but you played for several different coaches. Did you have one coach that stood out to you as being your favorite coach to play for?
I would say either Don Nelson or Coach Tibbs. The reason I would say Don Nelson, because he was my first coach. He took the chance on me, you know, and threw me out there. And his system was like, is none other. All his plays, I used to run his plays from our daughter's team, and they worked to perfection. All his plays awesome. Still work. And the running gun system is something that I love. And it's definitely one of the best, I think. And then Coach Tibbs, because he just prepared us. He had us prepared. And he made us work hard, no matter. And he held everyone accountable, no matter if you were Derrick Rose or you're the last 15th player on the bench. He wanted everyone to be the same, to come with the same focus, the same tenacity, and that's why we were so successful.
When you were in Indiana, did you ever get a chance to have any interaction with Larry Bird?
Oh yeah, for sure. Larry would come out to practice. You'd always watch practice, and he'd always talk trash. He was a big trash talker at practices, telling people he could outshoot you and all that kind of stuff. But he was definitely fun to be there. Very nervous when he was watching practices.
You didn't have any interactions like Jordan had in the Last Dance with them there after game 7 after he beat 98.
Him. Yeah, no, I didn't have I didn't talk to Larry like that. He was like my boss. I was like, hey, I was walking on eggshells.
Oh, absolutely. I can totally understand that.
Right,
Larry Legend. You probably don't want to talk trash to him.
Yeah, you definitely don't.
For sure. All right, so give me, if you had to boil it down, just like I asked you with high school and college, one or two things that stick out about your pro career, one or two things that you're like, man, that was really one of the best moments of my life as an NBA player.
I would just say maybe getting to the Eastern Conference Finals with the Bulls and the Pacers. It was definitely a big opportunity to get there and to go against a guy named LeBron James who stopped us from getting to the finals. but it was definitely fun to do that. And I would just say over the course of the 10 years, just just being resilient, having the longevity that I had, and being able to bounce back from injuries and things like that nature, and just do something that I love to do.
All right, when we're thinking about your teams going to the Eastern Conference Finals, what does the media throng look like compared to a regular season game? So by the time you get to the conference finals, what does it look like in terms of how much media is there around the team compared to, you know, a regular season game in January?
It's crazy. It's double, triple the size, because they want any kind of information they can get. They're asking any kind of questions. Sometimes they're starting drama, you know, and just trying to pin people against each other just for no reason. But you got to kind of stay focused and not pay attention what the media is saying or what your family members or friends are saying and stuff like that. But just kind of be focused. And like Tibbs would always say, just keep everything in the locker room, and only people that are going to be there for you are the ones sitting right next to you and the coaches. So I feel like that's just a great title to have and to stay focused on during those type of runs.
What's it like playing in a 7-game series back and forth against the same team that many times in such a short time span? Even people who are out there listening who have played high school basketball, or maybe you've played college basketball, unless you've played in the pros, you haven't played in a 7-game series where you see this team over and over again. You get to make adjustments. I'm sure they start to wear on your nerves, and you start to see them and just like, I can't stand these guys anymore. Just talk a little bit about what that's like.
It's really funny, because we played LeBron a couple times in the playoffs, and our coach Tibbs, we knew everything about LeBron and everything he wanted to do, like going right, going left, and he would quiz us days before games on the player you're guarding. We would have to mimic them and tell them what their tendencies were. So we knew everything about him. And like over a 7-game series, you tend to see the pros and cons of players, and then you also develop like not a hate relationship for them, but you just don't like them because you're going up against them so many times, and you have to play against them, and you guys are all going for that one specific thing, which is to win and try to get to the finals. But it's definitely cool, but in the midst of it, it's definitely kind of draining, but it's fun at the same time.
What does an off day look like in between games in a series? Are you guys walking through stuff? Are you watching film? Just talk about what goes on the off days in a series.
We're mostly watching film, mostly going through things on the court, but not at full speed, putting in different plays, because by the time the playoffs come, everyone knows your playbook, so you got to throw different things in there to catch them off guard and kind of get those easy points or those easy fouls. Those possessions kind of mean a lot, especially in a playoff series when the games can be decided by one or two possessions. So those days are kind of low-key, but you can get shots in if you want. You can lift weights just to rehab your body, because you're definitely, by that time, the season, you played 82 games, and you're in the conference finals, there's another maybe 10 or 15 games. Your body's probably beat up, so you want to get that rest as much as possible.
I would think that by that point of the season, that it's just to the point where I know you always hear about, and people, when you're thinking about NBA teams and how little they practice during the season, I know one of the things that always amazes me is guys who get traded midseason.
Yeah.
And they come in and the teams aren't practicing at all, and then all of a sudden, here they are on the full floor trying to figure it out. So maybe talk about what's that like when a guy gets traded in the middle of the season and comes into a new team. How do you get them caught up to speed?
We do a lot of kind of semi practices, going over a lot of plays, either with the second team or third team. Guys are staying around. It's a lot of film being watched by the player, just trying to throw them into the mold, into the fire, and kind of like learning their tendencies also. You got to learn where they want the ball, where their best spots are at. And that's pretty basic, really, because like you said, there's not a lot of practice time to do that. Basically, you just have to go in the games and kind of figure it out as the season goes along.
All right, let's bring it to the modern NBA and kind of the situation that we're all in now with trying to figure out whether or not the league's going to come back and play, and kind of put on your player hat and imagine that you were still in the league right now. What would you be hoping for, advocating for, in terms of what you think it's going to look like when the league comes back?
I would say just if I was one of those 16 teams, I don't think if they're not one of the 16 playoff teams, they should be playing. I don't know. That's just my opinion. I think it's a waste of time if the other teams are playing. But if I'm one of those 16 playoff teams, I would try to be in the best game shape I can be. Trying to stay healthy, keep my mind fresh, and really just worried about my safety, I guess, and the
Absolutely.
Safety of the teammates.
In your mind, how long would it take? So now we've been off since March. How long will it take when, let's say that things open up and they say, okay, we're going to start whatever this reduced training camp or whatever it's going to be. How long do you think it takes a player to get back to where you're in complete shape? And then I've got to believe that, especially if they don't go back to any regular season games, or if they jump right to the playoffs where
right.
clearly the intensity level is going to be super high compared right. to even what it would be if they opened up with some regular season games. What do you think that's going to look like from a quality of play, and how long do you think it's going to take guys to really get their game legs back?
I would say a couple of weeks to a month just to get back in game shape. And then, like I said, I mean, guys are probably staying in shape, running, doing lifting weights, all that kind of stuff, but it's really nothing like a real game to get you back in shape. So I would say at least a couple of weeks just for practice time, just to get guys back adjusted, get the chemistry back together, because at the one point in the time, a lot of teams were clicking and the chemistry was so high. But now that they're off, I mean, it's going to take a couple of weeks to get that chemistry back. So it's going to definitely take some time.
Yeah, I would think it would be a huge challenge. It's almost like a completely new season. I've kind of equated it to sort of the old bowl system with college football, where these teams finish playing in November and then they don't play again until January 1. It's like, okay, you take 5 or 6 weeks off in the middle of the season, then you try to come back. It's almost like it's a whole new season. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what all these teams and then what the individual players
right.
look like. And there's been so many interesting proposals
yeah.
thrown out there about what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. Is your gut telling you that they're going to be just the straight 16 teams, East and Western Conference, top 8 seeds, and they play it that way with 4 7-game series? Or do you think they're going to try to do something innovative, at least maybe with the first round? What's your gut telling you?
My gut telling me they'll just do the playoff teams, and somehow I don't know if they'll do just East and West. Maybe they'll just all mix it all up, and you know, just eventually we might have the championship. We might be a Western Conference team versus a Western Conference team. So that's how I think it might play out.
It's gonna be very interesting to see. I'm really curious to see how they're gonna come back, what it's gonna look like, and whether or not they decide to try to do something different, maybe to capture people's attention, as if people's attention isn't going to be on it anyway because of just all of us sitting around and no live
right.
sports and
right, yeah.
everybody's life has been completely disrupted. So let's talk a little bit about your life after basketball. Talk about what the transition for you has been like retiring as a professional athlete, what you've been up to, what it was like to set the ball down and not play anymore. And then we can get into some of the interesting things that you've been doing.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So it was definitely an adjustment. I thought, even when I was done playing in 2018, that I still could play, still can maybe go out there and play another maybe 1 or 2 years. But I just felt like the way my body was feeling, I wanted to be able to walk on my own and, like, you know, 50 or 60, stuff like that. So
understood.
Just try to make a wise decision for myself and also for my kids at the end of the day. But I thought I gave it a good run. I left everything out there. I got to play the game that I love for a number of years, and definitely wasn't trading for anything else in the world.
What was your plan when you decided to retire? What were you thinking you were going to do at that point?
Honestly, I really wasn't going to do anything. I was just going to sit back and take my kids to school and go to their concerts and games and stuff like that, since I never could with the hectic basketball season. So I was just going to be the dad taking and dropping kids off and just playing the mom role for a minute.
That's cool. How many kids you have?
2 and 1 on the way.
Nice. Awesome. Congratulations. So at what point did that not change? Because obviously I'm sure you're still doing those things and still love doing those things. But when do you start to get a little itch to try and maybe do something different, something new that you hadn't done before?
Yeah, I just wanted to keep being an inspiration. I felt like it was the inspiration playing in the NBA, and a lot of kids think that's very cool, and that's their dream goal. And I just thought, sitting on the couch one day, I wanted to continue to be an inspiration, continue to inspire kids. And that's when I came up with the idea to write a book and to inspire kids. And I thought, why not put my stories and put some inspiring messages in a book, and kids will be able to read it, and kids need to read, and kids need to keep developing, all that kind of stuff. So I said, why didn't not just kill two birds with one stone and write a book and put some little hidden messages in there that can inspire kids.
All right. Give us the 1 minute pitch on the book. And then I want to dive into your process from what it looked like when you first had that idea to what it looked like trying to get that book actually published. So give us the 1 minute spiel about what the book's all about and why people should go out and get it.
Okay. So the first book is called CJ's Big Dream. It's about CJ being a young kid, dreaming to play in the NBA, and wanting to get there, but doesn't know how to get there. And his goal is to continue working hard and to work hard to get to that platform. And he continues game by game and gets there. And the second book is about CJ's big project, and it teaches kids about education and how education is important. And you can't play sports unless you have your grade straight.
That's awesome. I love the message. I think it's great that you had in your mind to give back to the community, to kids, and to remember that at one point you were a kid. And I think to write it from that kid perspective is fantastic. So talk a little bit about your process of going from you're sitting on the couch one day, you have this idea. What does it look like going from that idea to actually having a published book? What's that process look like?
Yeah, so I one of my older coaches who I played for when I went to Italy, he actually wrote a book. So I contacted him and told him my idea, told him I wanted to write a book, but just don't know how to go about it or don't know anything about the book world or book life. So he introduced me to this lady named Tamika Newhouse, and she's written books before and she had her own company. And I talked with her and kind of just gave her all my ideas and stuff like that. And we eventually got my ideas onto paper. And that's how the book and the story came about. And I think that was a long 6 or 7 month process, just going and talking, having conversations with her about what I was doing as a kid, what I liked, what I didn't like, and making sure that the story still had an inspirational feel to it and kids can still relate to it.
Did the story and the details of it come to you pretty easily, or was the writing process more daunting than that? How would you describe the process that you went through to actually sit down and write it?
Well, actually, me and the lady Tamika, we both she wrote it, but I just gave her the ideas and the story and stuff like that.
Gotcha.
But the story and the ideas were basically all my views of growing up. The first book talks about living in the inner city, seeing different things like graffiti on the wall, uncut grass, things of that nature, and that kind of doesn't make CJ less focused, but it just makes him seem like those dreams that of accomplishing the NBA isn't real. So just kind of tells kids that no matter wherever you grow up, those things can still happen. You still can achieve your goals no matter where you grow up. So it's definitely those messages in there that I went through in my life that maybe other kids can relate to.
I think it's really cool that you were able to take your own story, your own details, your own journey, and put that into a book that kids can relate to and kids can follow that story. And just like we talked about right off the top of the podcast, when you were a kid, and that was my first question, and you talked about how you're playing on the driveway with your family and your brother and you're getting in fights. And at some point your family remembers you saying, hey, I want to play in the NBA. And you think about the number of kids that have that same dream. And when you're able to share your story and be able to show them that, you know, it wasn't super easy for you. You had obstacles you had to overcome. There were things in your environment that made it difficult for you to get where you wanted to go. I think that that's got to be inspiring, A, for you to write it, and then B, for you to know that there are kids out there reading that that maybe can take what you've written, what you've learned, and turn it into their own dream. And maybe that doesn't end up in the NBA, but maybe that ends up with them being a doctor or a lawyer or a fireman or whatever it might be. Right, I think that's to me, that's really cool.
Yeah, that was definitely the whole process. Like I said, growing up, I didn't really have any famous sports figures in my city. Only person that I knew that made it to the NBA was one of my high school coaches, and he was definitely a great figure in my life. So I just said, why couldn't I be that same figure that some kids might or might not have, and just give them the inspiration. Like I said, like you just said, it doesn't have to be playing the NBA. You can be an entrepreneur. You can be a doctor, a lawyer, whatever it is that those kids want to be. But there's no limitations to your dreams.
All right, tell people how they can find out more about the book. Where can they get the book? Just let us know a little bit about where we can find this thing.
You can find it on Amazon under the title CJ's Big Dream or CJ's Big Project. Or you can go to my personal website, CJPens, CJPENS.com, and purchase it there.
You have the idea for the third book already?
Yeah, I do have an idea for the third book. It's called CJ's Big Moment. It's about bullying. So I know a lot of kids might or might not get bullied, and just how to handle those type of situations. Because, like I said, these are real stories that happened to me when I was younger. So they definitely can relate to these stories. And I think bullying is a big subject for young kids.
How far out do you have titles? What number are you up to? Are you stuck at three, or do you have a few more titles in mind?
We're stuck at three right now, but working on the fourth one because the contract was four books. So after that fourth book, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. If I'm going to continue writing or telling stories or do something else. I'm not 100% sure yet.
Got any ideas of things if you end up leaving the book behind? Is there anything in your mind out there that kind of intrigues you that you might want to get involved in with it if an opportunity comes your way?
Everyone says I should be a coach, but I'm not sure. I don't know yet. I'm just still taking it day by day for now.
Yeah. How much do you miss the game? I mean, from a playing standpoint, from being around it day to day?
Definitely missing a lot. You miss the guys, the locker room, playing, traveling, things of that nature, the large crowds, the fans screaming, all that kind of stuff. But definitely don't miss the nights where I'm laying in bed and bones are aching and muscles are aching, but it's definitely nothing I would trade for in the world.
Absolutely. Very cool. CJ, I want to thank you for jumping on with us tonight. I want to give you one more opportunity. Just let people know where they can find you on social media, how they can reach out to you. Give them that information about the book again. We'll put it all in the show notes too, so they can reference it after you talk about it now. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Okay. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter, QuietStorm_32, the number 32. And you can go pick my books up at Amazon or CJPens.com, CJ's Big Dream and CJ's Big Project.
CJ, I can't thank you enough for spending almost an hour with us tonight. It's been a pleasure to be able to go through and talk to you about your career, both at the high school, college, and pro level, and then learn about the books that you're writing, the things that you're trying to do for kids and give back to your community. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.